Well, good morning again. Merry Christmas. We're allowed to say that now, like I said. Advent is actually kind of what it sounds like. If you know what the word Advent means, an Adventus, it's an expectation, it's an awaiting, it's a coming of the King. And before it was used by Christians, it was actually used by Romans, like not the book of Romans, but Romans. To talk about the awaiting or the coming of Caesar Augustus. So it's a very loaded word. And as we are now entering into or beginning the new church year, our thoughts turn to what it means to celebrate the coming of the King. And then, to borrow a phrase from Tolkien, the return of the King. But today, in order to shape our thoughts around that, we look at Jesus coming to begin really the reason why he was here. As he is approaching Jerusalem, this would not have been the first time he approached Jerusalem. He probably came many, many times, but this will be the last time. And our text, if you notice, begins with after he said these things. And right before that, he tells a very complicated parable. In fact, it's kind of in the top two of the most complicated parables. And we can confidently say that it's a difficult parable because there's no agreement on what it means. It's basically this one and another one in Luke 16. I am imposing a lot of self-denial here, because I wrote my thesis about that parable. And so it's so hard to not just take a really deep dive. But if you are having trouble sleeping, I can send you a 130-ish page thesis that will knock you right out. But suffice it to say, I think, and it fits all kinds of overall themes, and in the moment, I think the parable has less to do with Jesus' return and more about what Jesus is about to accomplish. Namely, the kingdom of God is about to show up in a very powerful way, and yet the things that people expected to be at the center of this kingdom, namely the temple and the city of Jerusalem, won't be. And in fact, in two-ish chapters, Jesus is going to prophesy, and turns out he's right, that it's all going to just be destroyed. So he tells this very heavy, ominous parable, and then goes up on ahead, leaving his disciples either going, "What was that about?" And even today we go, "Now, okay, what was that about?" And then Jesus, it seems sort of odd. They're approaching the outskirts of Jerusalem, Bethany and Bethphage, and the scene is kind of famous. He says, "Go," you know, sends a couple of his disciples, "You're going to find a colt. No one's ever ridden on it. It's tied up. Untie it. Anyone bugs you about it, just say, 'The Lord has need of it.'" And I've probably said this before, but if I'm at the mall and I go outside and someone's breaking into my little Civic and they say, "The Lord has need of it," I'm going to call my insurance company and the police, probably in that order. Well, I probably won't do anything because they may be armed. Who knows? But either way, my response will not be, "Oh, well, then go right ahead, please." And so it's been kind of a long-running question of why. Why do they just seem okay with it? And I think the best answer is that Jesus actually has friends who live right there. You know, Mary, Martha, Lazarus. You know, Lazarus come out. He was the guy that was dead and then wasn't. He's been there lots of times. They probably know him, just the general community. So I suspect when the people are going, "Hey, whoa, slow down," and then they say, "The Lord has need of it," "Oh, I know who you are. Yeah, okay, fine. I'm not going to tell him no. And then they start getting kind of weird. They take off their outer cloaks and put them on the colt, and they put him on it. And there's the echoes of the prophet Zechariah, who talks about the coming of the king. And then they lay their cloaks down on the road before him. I think this is largely symbolic of the moment. Notice that Luke does not mention palm branches. This is not Palm Sunday, quote unquote, even though it is. It's Cloak Sunday? I don't know. But I think what's interesting to me is that the image still works. I mean, if somebody were to walk in into the lobby in the church, and we all started taking off our jackets and putting them down in front of them, it would be weird, but it would indicate that we have a certain opinion about that person walking in. Something special is happening here. Now, they seem to be singing from Psalm 118, which is a song that you sing as you approach Jerusalem on a pilgrimage, and they are about to start Passover in the moment, and so, of course, they would be singing these songs about the coming of the king, and you know, Hosanna, save us now, and blessed is the king who comes in the name of the Lord. There are so many royal overtones that make it abundantly clear that this is about, whatever else it may be, the king entering the holy city. Which is why Pharisees approach Jesus and say, hey, tell your disciples to cool it. Now, we are often used to reading the Pharisees. Those are two different groups. The Pharisees as the bad guys, the foils, the ones who are just no fun at parties. And Luke's actually pretty careful about this. That's not always the case. And in fact, there are four, maybe five moments, even just in the book of Luke, where the Pharisees, at least some of them, seem to support Jesus. And that makes sense. The Pharisees were a very divided, split group. And so we don't actually have to read this as the Pharisees being the bad guys. They could just be cautious. Because they know that this is Passover. And because Passover is always a tense time, if you are a Roman authority trying to keep the peace, because the people are about to celebrate a moment in their history that is full of liberation, that if anyone's going to get any ideas about revolt or freedom, it's going to be now. And there was at least one time, I think in about a generation or two, when that's exactly what happened, that the Roman presence would have been increased by a lot. And so at the very least, they're saying, teacher, tell them to keep their mouths shut, because if the Romans get wind of this, it's going to end badly, at least for you and your disciples. But Romans have a tendency to grab and kill indiscriminately and then assume that the gods will sort them out. And then Jesus, always being very cryptic, says if they are quiet, then the stones will cry out. Now, at that point, he can see the holy city. This is not in our reading, but the landscape or the broad scenic view of Jerusalem would have opened up as they are cresting the Mount of Olives. The most prominent thing in that skyline would be, of course, the temple. And then Jesus bursts into tears because he knows that this is not going to go well for him. And because it doesn't go well for him, it is not going to go well for the future of his people. It's going to get complicated and dark. So what I want to look at just for a moment, most specifically is that line, the stones will cry out. I've never heard a stone cry. And there's some disagreement about what Jesus means by this. Is this tapping into something very primal? I mean, the later rabbis would say that if no one will speak up for justice and righteousness, that in fact the very stones of creation are capable of crying out. I don't know if they mean that metaphorically or if this is some kind of weird ancient superstition. Who knows? But I think the best explanation, and the one that makes the most sense in the broader context, is that Jesus is quoting from everybody's favorite minor prophet, Habakkuk. I know you have it memorized, but for those of you who can't remember it, there's a portion in Habakkuk where the prophet, being the prophet, of course, is giving a series of woes. Not like, whoa, but woe, like W-O-E, woe to you. Danger, warning, hey, this is bad. And one of those has to do with injustice, with oppression, and really economic injustice. But essentially, the people in power, the people with means, stepping on the little people. Those who are struggling, those who are on the margins. And at the end of that particular woe in chapter 2, it says that the stones in the walls will cry out against them. This seems like the clearest reference that Jesus has in mind, and it actually makes perfect sense. That parable that I'm having a hard time skipping over it, but I am, is all about economic injustice. It is all about the people with power stepping on those without it, the people with money using that money in predatory ways to crush those around them and making a hefty profit in return. And as it turns out, the temple itself is at the center of all of these misdealings. And so I think what Jesus is saying is that if the disciples aren't welcoming the king who is coming, then invoking Habakkuk, that creation is about to just cry out because there's nobody left to speak out for justice. Because Jesus, as the coming king, is, among many other things, one who brings justice. Now, it's Christmas, so on the one hand, yeah, we recognize this is the coming of the king. This is, you know, a big moment. Advent, it's royal. That's why now our paraments are blue, because it's a royal color. But Christmas, in the popular mind, is about the baby. You know, and there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, of course, we're celebrating Jesus' birth, and we'll, like, I don't know, some kids, like, sometimes for, like, a Sunday school thing, we'll bake a birthday cake for Jesus, which was always fun growing up because, hey, it's cake. You know, I'll miss the point, but I'll eat the cake. And we've got, you know, our manger scene here, but Jesus isn't there yet. He's actually, spoiler alert, he's in the pulpit. I guess as they were setting it up, and I can't let this go. In his hand, there's a little sign that says, "Hi, Eric." So whoever did that, fair play. Kind of looked like Katie's handwriting. Yeah, it is my wife. Okay. Because we're used to thinking about Christmas as kitsch. It's quaint. It's fun. It's light. And it can be all of those things. This is not a problem in and of itself. It is the recognition and celebration of the birthday of Jesus. Granted, the obnoxious historian in me has to say, we have no idea when he was actually born. There's some scant evidence it would have been in the fall, but I don't know. Doesn't matter. But the problem is that we tend to just see the birth of Jesus as the birth of Jesus. It's God in the flesh, Jesus' Son, born of the Virgin Mary, God of God, light of light, very God, begotten, not made, being of one substance with the Father, which we will confess in the creed, blah, blah, blah. But it's incarnation, it's God in flesh, and that's great. And babies are cute. But this is so much more. Because at some point we have to make a connection. We have to connect this dot, the dot of the, you know, away in the manger, you know, no cry he makes, or I can't remember the actual lyrics, which is just a lie. Babies are loud. And he lays down his sweet head. To Jesus, 30-ish years later, picking a fight with the most powerful people in that region. Because they have not done what God has commanded them. Not only have they been commanded to be purveyors of justice, to dispense mercy on his behalf, to cultivate the presence of God in a way that it allows the average human being to get closer to the terrifying, almighty, perfect, radiant presence of the ineffable, infinite, all-creator of the universe, who instead became purveyors of oppression, of greed, injustice, that basically they become like conduits of the worst that humans can offer. And then when Jesus challenges them, he loses badly. In fact, it doesn't get much worse than that. What starts in a very quaint, cute, almost kitschy sort of Hallmark moment of this little baby born to a poor family in the backwoods city in a backwoods part of the empire goes all the way to a big, big loss. So how do we make that connection? Well, obviously, if Jesus' life started the way it did, it had the trajectory that we are familiar with. He becomes in 3 years over the course of 3 years, a very well-known, popular, quite famous teacher. And then he goes and challenges the authorities and loses horrifically. He would be maybe a footnote in history. He'd probably still show up in some writing by a guy named Josephus, maybe as like a footnote. And that's the end of the story. And we would not be here today. Instead, he's welcomed as king into Jerusalem, which would maybe raise the question, maybe not in our minds, because we know where this is going, but in the minds of those around him, what kind of king does this represent? What kind of kingship? What kind of kingdom? Because there were lots of kings. Kings come and go in the ancient world. Sometimes very quickly, in 20-ish years, there will be a year within the Roman Empire where there are four emperors. That was a bad year. So first off, what kind of kingdom would Jesus represent? And it's one that tends to turn things upside down. Because if you look very carefully over the course of his life, the people who are pushed to the margins suddenly find themselves at the center of what Jesus is doing. If there is something wrong with you, or there are things about you that cause people to push you away, and it is 100% your fault, Jesus seems to be attracted to them, and they, of course, are attracted to him. The people who should have gotten it, the educated and the elite, have a tendency to push Jesus away, because if he's right, then they lose everything. And the people who, frankly, have nothing to offer God or anybody else are suddenly given places of dignity. The poor are given hope, the hungry are fed, the naked are clothed. Those are descriptions of a kingship that is very different from the power-hungry grab that the people are used to. And so this baby whose birth we'll celebrate in three plus weeks, is going to start advocating and enacting this kind of reality. And I think we can all agree that the reality that I just described, that Jesus has a tendency to just draw to him, and he has a tendency to create, as though it were the creator himself walking around in his creation. That the kingdom that he describes is better. I want to live in that. I'd much rather live in that than what I live in now. Although our prayer is always more of that in what we live in now. That's your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. That's catchy. We should repeat that every week. That's actually really radical. There was a time when that'd get you killed. Sometimes we take it for granted. But as if to underscore everything that Jesus did and everything he was as this baby whose birth we will celebrate grows up to be a man after working as some kind of day laborer with his dad until his dad dies, and then onward while studying and learning his scriptures, as he will then enter into this moment where he is now being hailed as king, knowing it is all about to collapse around him. Instead of ducking and running, getting out of there because he knew they were coming after him, he gave himself. And as it turns out, that upside down nature of the kingdom that he is bringing, that brings the people on the margins, the broken, the needy, the oppressed, those who are hungry, those who are thirsty, those who are naked, those who frankly destroy all of the relationships that they are in, and they are stuck in these cycles that they can't break, those who are addicted, those who are greedy, those who have lost everything because of that or that other thing, whether it's something done to them or what they frankly did to themselves and everything else. As it turns out, as he draws all of them to him, he is going to take all of that and he is going to force his enemies to kill that with him. He's taking the whole ship down. Now we're getting to why Christmas is a big deal. And even if Jesus had made some pretty crazy claims that he was taking all of that onto himself, and then he died, and if he were to stay dead, then, well, nice try. It was a good thought. And it isn't till that moment when he is talking to his disciples, interacting with them, kind of as though nothing had happened, but it's very clear that many things have just happened, that they realize that not only has he done that, but he has defeated death, and that kingdom that he had been talking about and enacting and bringing into our world is now permanent. And that's why we keep praying, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth, here, now, as it is in heaven. Christmas is not, we can celebrate Jesus' birthday. Christmas is a foretaste of Easter. Christmas exists because Easter happened. Because it represents the beginning of heaven come to earth. So, Merry Christmas. Please rise as you are able.